This is The Third Degree. I'm Jessica Minchell. On the show today, how the building of new coal-fired power stations can qualify for carbon credits under the UN's Clean Development Mechanism. And where does Australia stand 5 years on from the passing of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples? The Clean Development Mechanism is the United Nations carbon trading framework. To meet Kyoto Protocol reduction targets, nations can offset their domestic emissions by supporting projects such as renewable energy and public transport in other parts of the world. However, these so-called credits now also include the creation of new coal-fired power stations. This isn't the first time the Executive Board of the Clean Development Mechanism has decided coal can qualify for credits, but this most recent inclusion goes against its own technical advice. Stephen Hertz is a senior attorney with the Sierra Club, and he's based in San Francisco, and he spoke with The Third Degree.
Sierra Club's the sort of the largest and oldest grassroots environmental organization in the United States. The Clean Development Mechanism is a part of the Kyoto Protocol. It was agreed under the Kyoto Protocol. And what it does is there was a recognition that because carbon emissions are global, climate change is a global problem, it doesn't necessarily matter where the emissions reductions take place. So under the Kyoto Protocol, the developed countries took on commitments to reduce their emissions, and the developing countries did not. And the developed countries, particularly industries within the developed countries, said we need to figure out a way to limit the costs that we will bear in terms for reducing our emissions. And so one of the ways they did that is they said, if we can figure out ways to reduce emissions in developing countries, we can generate offsets from those emissions reductions and use them in place of emissions reductions that we would do at home. And so that's the basic mechanism. And the quid pro quo there was that it's called the Clean Development Mechanism because developing countries are supposed to get investment capital for clean investments, and in return, developed countries get offsets that they can use to meet their reduction commitments.
And what sort of offset programs, very broadly, are currently included in the scheme?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that you can generate credits. So there are a number of different methodologies that apply to various different sectors. So if you want to do small-scale renewable projects, that's one methodology. If you want to do hydropower, there's a methodology. There's methodologies for more efficient production of steel or cement. They're sector-specific. And basically what they all try to do is to establish a baseline, which is what would be the project that would be built if there were no access to the CDM, if there were no Clean Development Mechanism revenue. And then you say, what project will we build with the money that we can get, with the extra investment? And then you take the baseline and subtract the more efficient, cleaner project, and the difference is the amount of what they call certified emission reductions, or the credits that the project can then sell to developed countries' emission trading markets.
And that's really been one of the strongest criticisms of the scheme, which is that it's been working in this hypothetical, which is that, say, governments
Absolutely.
Can say that they're planning to log a certain number of hectares a forest. Whether or not that is the case is a different issue. But if they then decide to formally log even a smaller amount, then they can generate these credits out of that.
Absolutely. There's a lot of gamesmanship that goes on with the generation of credits. So there's two problems in particular. One is, what's the baseline? And it's in the project proponent's interest to inflate the baseline and to say that the project that would have been built, the hypothetical counterfactual project, is as inefficient as possible, so that the project that they intend to build looks better by comparison and generates more credits. That's the first problem. The second problem is what they call additionality. And so you have to show that the project, the more efficient technology or the cleaner process, would not be used were it not for the availability of clean development revenue. And that's often not the case. So, for example, with regard to a lot of the Indian coal projects that we looked at, they were all going to use what they call supercritical technology anyway, which is a more efficient way to burn coal. But yet they claimed that they wouldn't. They claimed the baseline was what they call subcritical coal, which is less efficient, and they applied to get the emission reductions credits for the difference. But it was all fictitious. I mean, they were going to use the more efficient technology anyway. And in fact, in some cases, they were required by law to use the more efficient technology.
With the coal-fired power stations, this is actually something that there's been a recent decision by the Clean Development Mechanism to incorporate coal formally as part of the scheme. Can you explain some of that backstory there?
Yes. So as I was saying earlier, there's different methodologies for calculating credits in a number of different sectors. There had been one for coal for a long time, and it had been revised several times. But it was pointed out that it was it had a methodological flaw. It had a lot of methodological flaws, but one that was sort of commonly agreed was that it was inflating the baseline. So it was overestimating how much the baseline project, the project that would be built if it weren't for CDM revenues, was. And the way it was doing that was it was not taking into account the fact that through technological innovation, projects will get incrementally more efficient over time. So the coal plant that you build in, say, 1990 will be more efficient than the one you built in 1985, and it'll be more efficient. That one will be more efficient than the one you built 5 years earlier. And, you know, there's an incremental technological progression that they weren't taking account of. So they put the methodology on hold, and they turned it over to what they call their methodology panel, which is a panel of experts that's supposed to revise it. And they came back with a set of recommendations that would have tightened up the eligibility, and the board considered it, sent it back to the MESS panel to look at it again. They came back with even more stringent recommendations. And then what just happened recently is the board approved a new methodology, taking on board some of the recommendations but leaving a lot of the recommendations aside. And so some of the problems were fixed, but a lot of them weren't.
And what are the recommendations that were not followed?
Well, this is where it gets really technical. But what it has to do with is the way that some elements of how you calculate the credits. So, for example, I'll give you just one example. There's a pool of projects that will be moving through the pipeline at any given time. And what the MESS panel recommended is that when they look at the baseline, in other words, what's the average project, what's the normal project that you'll build, you should look at some of the projects that are in the CDM pipeline, because that's the type of project that's being built now. And you sort of, they should be part of the pool that you average to determine the baseline. Well, the the board decide to leave those projects out. So any project that applies for CDM credit is not part of the baseline. That just misrepresents the nature of the project pools or the stream of projects that are actually being built in a country in ways that will inflate the number of credits that a project is eligible for.
And how significant do you think it is now that they have gone with, after reassessing the situation, coal-fired power stations can now be part of this carbon credit scheme?
Well, that remains to be seen. You know, there's, as I said, there are real problems with the additionality of the projects that are being coming before the board, and there are other problems as well. And they always have the discretion to look at the project and say, we don't think this is eligible. So, and they have done it in the past. They have not accepted all the projects that have applied. So it may be the case, in an optimistic scenario, that they've gotten enough pressure to revisit the methodology, they will also be more rigorous in applying the new methodology, and it'll be much more difficult for projects to get through. But we'll see. The other factor that's actually really interesting is that a lot of the projects that were in the pipeline or were nominally queued up to be considered for credits have actually are not necessarily going to be developed. And the reason is because of severe coal shortages and volatility in the Asian coal markets has turned a lot of the turn the economics of a lot of these projects upside down. So in particular, India was the biggest source of projects coming into the pipeline, and it's really hard to build a coal plant in India right now because of domestic coal shortages and really high prices on the international coal markets. So a lot of the projects that were nominally in the pipeline may not actually come before the board for consideration anytime soon.
Coal shortages is certainly not something that we hear a lot about here in Australia.
Well,
aspect of it.
In India, they have very low-grade coal, and they have problems meeting domestic demand. So coal, India has increasingly looked abroad for supply. And there's been a lot of recent volatility in international coal markets, and prices are historically very high, although they've come down somewhat recently. And what's happened is some projects have put in very low bids for the electricity tariff that they promised to sell their power at. And with the changes in the international coal markets, it's become clear that a number of these projects are not going to be able to meet the promised tariff rate. And so they're not going to follow through with construction, or they're not, if they're far along in construction, they're not going to build, they're not going to operate the plants until something changes. Either they negotiate a higher tariff rate with the government, or or coal prices come down considerably.
That's Stephen Hertz from the Sierra Club in the United States, speaking about the UN's decision to have new coal-fired power stations be able to qualify for carbon credits under the Clean Development Mechanism. Last month marked the fifth anniversary of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. But what has this international convention meant in Australia? Since 2007, there's been a national apology to the Stolen Generations, a look at constitutional recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. But this has happened all while there has been the intervention in the Northern Territory and the passing of the recent Stronger Futures legislation. 2SER's Stephanie Quinn begins her report with Stephen Keame, President of Australian Lawyers for Human Rights.
The Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is it's an interesting treaty because it's one of the few human rights instruments that are directed to group rights and in particular the emphasis on self-determination. But at the same time, the emphasis on group rights is not intended to affect any individual's human rights more generally in the instrument. So I think that issue of self-determination is something that has to be worked out on the ground in lots of different countries in lots of different ways. So you can ask, what is self-determination? Is it determination of all the Indigenous peoples in Australia, or is it self-determination at the clan level or at the community level or whatever? So I think it's something that probably has been a focus of Australian public policy as opposed to the assimilation policies of the 50s and 60s. But it's interesting and it's something that will continue to work itself out for decades into the future, I think.
In July, shortly after the Stronger Futures legislation passed through the Senate, your organisation called on Parliament to refer those laws to a new Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights. Why was this?
As an organisation, ALHR decided that it didn't want to argue the rights and wrongs of the Stronger Futures legislation. I mean, that's an area of quite controversial public policy. You'll remember that the Northern Territory Emergency Response Act, or the intervention that took place in 2007, was announced and implemented within weeks, if not days. It was justified by reference to the Little Children Are Sacred report, and yet it didn't really seek to implement almost any of the recommendations of that report. The Stronger Futures legislation, I suppose, could be broadly described as something that is intended to continue a lot of the policies of the intervention, but to do so in a way which is certainly less critical on human rights grounds and on other policy grounds as well, including, I suppose, the issue of self-determination. What the government has done is to say, well, we don't suspend the operation of the Racial Discrimination Act, and therefore we think that all of the provisions in the Act are justified as being affirmative action. What ALHR thought was that that's an interesting and controversial claim, that it is affirmative action, and because the other initiative of the government, namely a human rights committee, was set up to examine legislation for its compliance with international human rights instruments, because that was coming into effect at about the same time, we thought, well, this is the perfect sort of measure which should go to the Human Rights Committee so that the claims with regard to being in compliance with human rights instruments could be looked at in a rational and way with a proper policy and all of that. The government chose not to do that. In a way, they rushed through the Stronger Futures legislation so that it was through the Parliament before the committee started to operate. And so that's what we were addressing at that stage, saying, well, it should go through the right process.
The Stronger Futures package allows continued welfare quarantining and alcohol management in certain communities in the Northern Territory. And one of the major concerns is that Indigenous peoples were not properly consulted on this. Do Indigenous peoples have a legal right to be consulted before such laws are imposed on them?
Yes, there is a provision in international human rights, including the Declaration, that legislation affecting the rights of Indigenous people should be the subject of properly informed consent. A bit like self-determination, that's a question, or the content of that is something that can be argued about. And it's probably, it probably applies differently across public policy areas as opposed to something where somebody is being asked to give up their traditional tribal lands or something like that. Again, it's an issue that the committee could consider in more detail.
The Human Rights Committee has shown interest in reviewing the Stronger Futures Act, but critics maintain Indigenous communities themselves were never properly consulted on the laws. Michelle Harris is a human rights supporter and former director of Torture and Trauma Services in Canberra.
The reality is that the people were consulted in 2009, They were consulted again in 2011. And then early this year, 2012, we had the Senate inquiry visiting two communities, the communities of Nataria or Hermansburg and the community of Maningrida. We then had the committee sitting down with people in Darwin for 2 days and another day in Alice Springs. And really, the message was fairly consistent from the communities and from the support agencies working with Aboriginal people that a very large portion of the Stronger Futures legislation was not acceptable. And then the community members certainly weren't accepting that legislation. Not only weren't they accepting it, very often it wasn't understood and it was seen as the same or a continuation of the earlier legislation. Communities are different. Each community deserves to sit down, as they've requested many, many times, with government and to work with government in what is a genuine partnership to move forwards. That's simply not happening. Decisions are being made far, far away. Probably on paper they look pretty good, but the reality is, on the ground, they don't work. And they don't work because the people who are affected don't have any engagement in those decisions, don't have any ownership. Many communities were well-functioning with organisations that were community organisations that were doing great work. The approach was a blanket approach, and it has treated all communities equally, not recognised the differences.
Part of the government's push towards better protections of Indigenous rights has been an inquiry into their recognition in the Constitution. Last week, it was announced there won't be a referendum on the issue, but rather the government will legislate an act of recognition in the hope that will build momentum for constitutional recognition in the next 2 years. Stephen Keim says this is a positive, be it a symbolic step.
I think this is another really interesting area. I think that symbolic issues are really important, but of course, on their own, they're insufficient to change the lives of people. And I suppose that's something that we can see from the aftermath of the apology, which took place in the beginning of 2008. I think that apology was really important. I think it has been really important. I think it's changed a lot of people's feelings about who are members of the stolen generation, that they feel more affirmed, less aggrieved with regard to those matters. But of course, it doesn't get rid of controversy in the area as to what other things should be happened to right those wrongs. Mm. And I think it's true with regard to legislative or constitutional recognition of Indigenous people won't change the existence of the world. Often there's fear-mongering with regard to proposals like that, which is usually pretty baseless because it's not actually going to change things on the ground enormously. But again, that symbolism is really important. As to whether a referendum would get through, and therefore whether it's, if you're pessimistic about that, whether it's better to legislate and build up the momentum, as you said, you know, is a policy decision. And I think the legislative recognition certainly is a positive step. Whether it's disappointing that the constitutional recognition is not being pursued, that's a matter for people to judge.
Look, I would say one of the good things that's come out of meetings with the UN has been the decision to have a parliamentary joint committee on human rights in this country, so that new legislation is reviewed by that committee to ensure human rights are being protected. Mm-hmm. What disturbs me very much is that the Stronger Futures legislation was tabled a few days before that legislation went through. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it didn't come before that committee. Now, since then, the National Congress of Indigenous Peoples has asked for that to be scrutinised. The response by the Minister and the Attorney General has been it doesn't need to be scrutinised. Now, I don't think that is in the spirit of the declaration. Now, I believe that the committee is still considering what it will do, and a number of people have asked for scrutiny to take place. You see, I think once you have legislation that has been scrutinised in that way, government can feel more relaxed about what it's trying to achieve. But while it's taking this defensive sort of position, I think nobody's comfortable at all. You would seize it and say, of course we would like that to be scrutinised. And the fact that government haven't done that is a reason for discomfort. But the people that I've spoken to, I mean, it's the message is consistent. People have been disempowered. People feel devastated that they've lost control over their lives, that especially that the shires have taken over control of communities. Lives have been hugely disrupted. And there's a great hope that now there's been a territory election, that maybe somebody will do a little bit more listening. And I think it's a matter of wait and see.
That report is by 2SER's Stephanie Quinn. And on this note, very quickly, last weekend saw this year's meeting of the Australian Nuclear Free Alliance, or ANFA, in Alice Springs. This alliance is formed by Aboriginal people, environment and health groups and trade union representatives who are all concerned about uranium and nuclear projects in Australia. Part of that meeting statement, or a meeting statement, came out of that event, and part of that focuses on a moratorium on all uranium mining and dumping of nuclear waste in Australia, pending a public inquiry into the impacts of all aspects of the nuclear industry, including uranium exploration, mining and exports, as well as health impacts on communities living with the legacy of nuclear weapons and uranium mines. So that's just a very short part of a much larger meeting statement, and that whole meeting statement is well worth a read. You can find the full statement online at AusNuke Free Alliance. So that's AusNukeFreeAlliance.wordpress.com. That's all we have time for on the show. This is The Third Degree. I'm Jessica Minchell. You're on 2SER, and coming up next is Steph with The Daily. Thank you.